This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not. Today, I'm doing crime. So, most crime books have twists and turns. Even red herrings are put in for the readers so that the murderer isn't solved too quickly. Lorena Carrington has done even more than that in her book, A Puzzling Pursuit. She has made the reader become the crime solver too. Welcome, Lorena.
Thank you so much for having me. Very happy to be here.
Well, I am too, because this book was fun. A Puzzling Pursuit starts in a small country town, an hour and a half out of Melbourne, with a weekly newspaper run by a very officious Michelle. Jerry, who thinks he should be writing Hollywood gossip columns, but instead he's stuck here organising the classifieds. There's our unnamed protagonist, and there's Kathy and Greg, and we're starting right away.
Greg is dead. You never really liked him. He didn't help the stereotype of the sleazy photographer in his black fake leather jacket, aviator sunglasses, and apparent queue of girlfriends. But you hadn't wished him dead. Well, not many times.
Of course the police are there and they ask everyone to clear their desks and leave. But there, on our protagonist's desk, there's a note where the splashes of blood on certain words spell a different message, and a scrap of paper under her keyboard uses a code word cipher. Both need quick solving. Why does this come so easily to our protagonist?
Well, luckily the protagonist is you, the reader, and you are very, very clever. And you are very, very good at puzzles. In the book, you work for this local newspaper as the puzzle writer and also general dog's body, really. So, you know, you're there because you have to, but life's not as exciting as it could be.
There's other notes. The challenge this protagonist, ready for a game of cat and mouse, and think you're so clever, the game is on. There's puzzles to a lot of localities in the country town. But then the life is endangered in the renovator's yard. What happens to her then?
It's only a piano hanging by a wire, as happens in small town renovator's yards.
Comes crashing down. Oh. The last thing the police would expect is for one of the suspects to disappear. And this is exactly what happens to the protagonist. So where are they off to?
Well, we go everywhere. We go all around Australia. Where don't we go in Australia? You, as the reader, are sent on a wild goose chase around Australia, starting off in your small town, which may or may not have some resemblance to my hometown of Castlemaine, and sent down to Melbourne.
In Melbourne, there's more puzzles. And the thought is that this person might be on a private art tour rather than a crime solving, because there's also another crime here.
That's right. Crimes just keep popping up all over the place.
This is art, and she has to solve it. Oh, the protagonist, and I'm sorry, I can't. In my mind, I had her gendered, and I've been told no.
I wrote it very specifically to not have the protagonist be gendered, because you, as the reader, are the protagonist. So whoever you are the one being sent off on this wild goose chase.
It's hard to read, but that crime is solved and there's a new place to move to. The protagonist wonders, why steal a painting or commit a murder, for that matter, only to send a total stranger on a wild goose chase? Now there's a destination, Geelong, and along the Great Ocean Road. I'm going to get Lorena Carrington to read from page 55.
Page 55. All right. The drive down the freeway gives you plenty of time to come up with more questions than you woke up with. This is ridiculous. What is going on? Is it actually connected to Greg's death? And why on earth are you just going along with it? Yes, you had been thinking last week you could do with a bit more excitement in your life. And you never have been able to resist a puzzle. But who does this? Also, why does your car smell faintly of tea? You change lanes and pass an old VW van which is chugging black smoke, is shuddering ominously.
Oh, yes, that Volkswagen.
Pops up.
It does pop up, as other things too. The protagonist has decided to name the puzzle setter X. as in X marks the spot. But this time, it's told to look after a person rather than find an object. Mm. So what is this big event that person's running away from?
Well, this poor hapless surfer happens to have a wedding in a few days, and it's not just the surf giving him cold feet.
The way that this runs in through the story is quite a wave in itself. So the big event he's escaping from. But Australia has many big events. Ned Kelly's statue in Victoria, Merino sheep in Goulburn. And then up the coast, there's the big banana, the prawn, the pineapple, the mango. X has set puzzles, but also little souvenirs at each locality, with a very happy ending for the surfer too. Look, this was just so tightly wound up. It was so cleverly put together, you know, all of this souvenir collecting. For what purpose? And we can't tell you that.
Spoilers.
But read 103 after the end of this happy reconciliation.
There is a happy something that happens at the end. You wander thoughtfully back to your car, having startled yourself, really, by sending a silent cheers to your mysterious ex back there at the bar. Are they a murderer, a trickster, or a wildly misguided do-gooder? Is this Stockholm Syndrome? Either way, there's a tiny part of you that hopes it's not quite time to head home yet. You can't help but smile a little at the sight of a white envelope wedged under the windscreen wiper of your car.
Another adventure. Another, and this time to an agricultural show. And who thought jam making could be so competitive, where a sick cat stops another person being murdered? Or is her life in danger? Now, what are some of the things, Lorena Carrington, that you've made this poor protagonist go out of their way to be in danger from?
Well, I tried to put them through as much as I possibly could. A lot of it was entertaining myself and hopefully entertaining the reader too. And there is a good reason why they're being sent on all these expeditions, explorations, and adventures around Australia. I won't spoil. I'm hoping it all ties up very neatly at the end, as all good crime books should.
You've written about the protagonist climbing from one train carriage to another on the outside, being in a haunted house, or nearly flung out of the door of an aeroplane without a parachute. And there is this man in the checkered shirt with a glint of silver metal poking out of the top of his jeans, just to add further suspense. But back to puzzles.
Back to puzzles.
In a remote pub with no beer, there's a dust storm outside so no one can come in or out, and a murder. Now, what's this based on?
The first idea for this case was the pub with no beer, which has been changed to the pub with no cheer. And I really wanted to use the trope of the kind of Agatha Christie style locked house murder mystery.
Oh, yes.
So they're instead of being stuck in a windswept mansion in the moors of England, then they're stuck in a pub in the middle of nowhere in Australia with a dust storm sweeping through, and there's no phone coverage conveniently enough to to help them.
Finally back home, and it's page 246, and this is the problem. The protagonist has been away all this time. And, of course, there's the Greg we started with. He's dead.
And the fact that you up and disappeared the day after he died isn't exactly a signal of innocence. X must have known it would cast some suspicion on you. So why were you led on this series of ridiculous goose chases while everyone at home became more and more suspicious of you?
Well, it all comes out at the end very cleverly, and it was just such a good read. But I just wonder how hard it was to write.
It was fun. It was a challenge. I learnt in creating this book that I'm a plotter. So I thankfully had set up a very strict framework for myself for the book before I started. So I knew where I was going and where I was leading you as well.
Garden path. In this pub with no beer, there's a this is when our protagonist meets a real novelist. So this is on page 168. So Lorinda Carrington's going to read a little bit more from A Puzzling Pursuit. But this actually makes a question the writing.
Yes. So here you're meeting a writer. So is the writing going well? He frowns like a storm cloud. I am a fraud, an imposter. My best days are behind me and I will never write anything worthwhile again. He can't be older than 25. Well, but this feeling will pass. I just need the right spark, the flash of inspiration, the kiss of the muse. You back away slightly. So how do you feel about word puzzles? Do they help keep your brain sharp? Pah! He waves his hand. I don't waste my time with puzzles. My brain is tuned to the delicate nuance of language. Why would I clutter it with games?
Isn't that beautiful?
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So you said it just in the hallway that this book was inspired. So it's a murder mystery, but you have to go through different puzzles in order to solve Is it sort of like a choose your own adventure in that case? Then is it written like that?
I was tempted to turn it into a choose your own adventure, as well as all the other complicated factors that I packed into it, and I thought that might be just taking it a little bit too far.
Yeah. Okay, so it reads through, but you then have to solve all these. Oh, it's such an inspired idea.
So yeah, there's a puzzle on each page which leads you through to the next little scenes. Yeah.
Okay.
And you can read it as a story. I wrote it very specifically because I know that there are some people who won't care about the puzzles and they're only interested in the story, and that's a good, hopefully, rollicking story that will keep you reading. And there'll be some people who are just in it for the puzzles and couldn't care less about
the
story. But I hope there are people out there in it for both.
Yeah.
The amount of different types of puzzles, I thought it was just incredible. There was the code words and the nonograms and the picture cross puzzle, anagrams, Sudoku, cryptic crosswords, go fish, Morse code, number codes, the logical deductions, spot the difference, mobile phones that don't have numbers and that where the letters are coded, and Scrabble anagrams. You know, there was a lot of puzzles in this and it was a lot of fun.
I'm so glad.
And is there a book two?
I hope so.
Oh, good, because we are left a little bit hanging.
Yeah, we can't tie things up too neatly just in case. I have started an outline and proposal and have written the first chapter for potentially a European tour.
Oh, I like it.
Well, this is by Penguin, and it's not quite their usual Penguin-type book, so was it difficult to get in?
Well, like most of the books and projects I've worked on, I kind of came at it from a sideways direction, and through talking to people and the way I collaborate with other writers and illustrators as well. So the short version of the long story is that I met Liam Runnels, who writes the cryptic crosswords for the Saturday Paper and The Age, and also does Minute Cryptic with Angus Tiernan online as well. And he has a couple of Penguin books of puzzles. He has Minute Cryptic that came out recently. But I had met him after I'd name-checked him briefly in a junior fiction book I'd written a few years ago called Leaf Letters, which has got a few secret codes and puzzles in it as well, but it's aimed for children. So I'd heard that he'd moved nearby. And, we met and had a few coffees, and I proofread one of his books and he introduced me to his publisher at Penguin.
And it all happened.
And I harassed them until they gave me a project.
A murder leads to a journey across Australia. There are other crimes within the story which require solving 100 puzzles, such as anagrams, nonograms, Morse code, logical deduction, Sudoku, cryptic crossword, and even using the letters of your mobile phone. A Puzzling Pursuit is a book of murder and mind teasers by Lorinda Carrington. Thank you so much. A lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now is my pre-record with Lindsay Bartels. My guest today is Lindsay Bartels. Her debut memoir is called Imogen in Waiting. Welcome, Lindsay.
Thank you, Lisa. It's lovely to be here with you.
Your memoir explores motherhood, reproductive choice, and the impossible decisions we make when we try to shape the future. Was this a very difficult memoir to write?
Oh, good question. It actually wasn't. I got to a place in my life where I felt a sense of relief, and I think there's an impossible choice in this story, and I had made what I felt was the impossible choice after mulling over it for maybe 5 years. And once I made the choice, I had this capacity in me open up to say, like, I think I need to share this story. So it really flowed out of me quite quickly.
Okay, so let's put the listener in the picture. So at 26, after surviving breast cancer and learning you carry, is it called the BRCA1 gene?
Yes, that's how I say it.
Okay. You were faced with the extraordinary decision of whether to bring into the world a daughter, who you name Imogen, who would inherit the same gene that made you decide to tell this story. And you, in fact, tell this story directly to Imogen in your novel, in your memoir.
Yes.
So why did you decide to write the book to Imogen?
Oh, so even though, as I already mentioned, I had made the choice, it is still so incredibly difficult and never feeling black and white for me when it comes to the idea of whether or not to bring an entity into being that is in the embryo form. And this is the modern medicine that I discuss in my memoir, and IVF, to know whether you're making the right choice or not. So I knew from the beginning, once I had come to this completion in my story, that I wanted to write it to Imogen, the embryo, and say, this is why I made these choices, and let me also remember myself, because it's hard. And there's a lot that went into it, and it was almost to document that journey to help remind me.
Yeah. And there's this fascinating tension throughout the book between agency and surrender. So it struck me that it's very much more than a story just about IVF. There is a lot about the choice that modern medicine gives us. Mm-hmm. And it seems that you were expected to make increasingly sophisticated decisions about reproduction while simultaneously being told that these decisions were entirely personal. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Very much so. So I was given so much information along the way, but in a very clipped pace most of the time. That started with my cancer diagnosis when I was young, in my 20s, and the ramifications of having this genetic mutation and what it could mean for the future. But all the while, there's so many ethical gray areas that doctors would be like, but it's your choice. And so the story really is about capacity in the end, like at the end of the day, and as my own individual self, what is my capacity and how do I own that and live in that truth?
Yeah.
It could go so many different ways.
Yeah. So let's take a step back. So initially at 26, you were diagnosed with cancer. And then it was obviously at 26. How was that for you?
Yeah. So very unexpected. I was living independently, starting a career, feeling otherwise completely healthy, and maybe I was taking in a little too much stress at work, but I think that's a very natural thing in your 20s. So I just wasn't expecting this diagnosis at all, and I didn't do breast exams. Like, I was just apathetic to that stuff.
Yeah,
it came just late at night. I was scratching kind of under my arm, and I felt something hard and like a little pebble under my skin. And I was like, ooh, that is not normal. And where did that come from? And that was kind of the instigator of the whole discovery. And I was like, I just need to get answers and kind of trust the sixth sense that I had that it wasn't normal.
And then so that kind of thrust you into this situation with your new partner, where you were suddenly rushed through to make some important life decisions about freezing eggs and so on. So
yes.
And so how long after did you decide to freeze eggs that you then decided to have a child?
Yeah, so the freezing the eggs, and at the time, this was 2009, there wasn't a whole lot of research around that as being a very tried and true, dependable option. And I had the privilege of my dad being an IVF specialist.
Yes.
And so that really helped kind of have his expertise guiding me a little bit along the way. And he was like, you know, embryos, which are fertilized eggs, are more reliable. And so that was the first of the impossible choices, was to make embryos with a man I was just a year into dating.
Awkward.
Like, yeah. Woo! I think of all the moments in the story, like, that was the hardest real life, like, oh my gosh, hello.
Yes.
I have to figure this out. And it was
very confronting.
I think about 5 years after that that I finally was ready to have children. And I'd done the fertility preservation up front because I knew I had to undergo, well, it was very likely I would have to undergo chemotherapy, which I ended up having to do. And that puts your ovaries at risk, even though you can now suppress them. And I did at the time with special medicine. And then you hope that after chemotherapy, your embryos plump back up and everything in there, like your eggs are okay. And, 5 years later, I did find that was the case for me, which was like the first miracle.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then you went on to have some embryos frozen, and then you went through the process of discovering, didn't you, that the embryos, which embryos to take at which time, and then you came across this big conundrum.
Yes. So in the U.S., you can learn the gender of your embryos. And initially, my husband then at the time, who luckily was my boyfriend 5 years prior, there were some touch and go moments in there that were edited out by my editor. That's okay. Wasn't the point of the story, but we made it to that phase. And our intent was to not pass on the risk of cancer to our future children, given this choice, which we felt like was incredible that could happen. And it was kind of the only way we knew to prevent cancer. Like, no one else was really talking about it. And we're like, wow, we're going to do this, because if we can keep our kids from having breast cancer, passing on breast cancer, if they're male, to future children and generations, let's do it.
Yeah.
And so that was our intent. But then once we got our results, there was some masked information. And I think it just sat on our minds too much that someone out there in the world knew more about our potential children than we did. Like the lab people knew which ones were male and female.
Wow.
And that's like the first weird conundrum of like, going through IVF and having modern medicine. Like, it's not just you in the creation seat with like nature. There's all these other hands involved, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, we let that get the better of us, and we're like, oh no, we need to know the gender. And if we hadn't, I wouldn't have written this whole story. But then we learned it, and we had two embryos that didn't have the BRCA gene, or genetic mutation is the more exact way I've learned to say it. And one was otherwise healthy and did, and the one that was otherwise healthy and had the BRCA1 mutation was female. And then I was like, oh my gosh, that's me. That's someone like me.
Yeah.
So then how can I say no to that? Is crazy.
And this was one of the most moving things about this book, is that you don't reduce your younger self, the woman who survived cancer, to someone who should have wanted to avoid that life. You clearly love your own life. Mm-hmm. So how did you hold these two seemingly contradictory truths together?
Yeah, I think I just had to focus on the next best step at the moment in time. And we did know we had two embryos that didn't have the genetic mutation and were male, and we were going to move forward with those. There's also a point in the book I say I read The Fault in Our Stars by John Green. And for whoever's read that, it's Oh, wow. So good. And I was like, yes, this is why we have made this decision and why we're not passing on the potential for cancer for our children.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then, you know, life evolves and you kind of forget things and your capacity expands. Like, I feel like as I got older and was privileged enough to have kids, my capacity expanded. And I was like, still thinking about this embryo. So there's a lot of back and forth.
Yeah.
Of figuring it out.
Yeah. So the book isn't only about reproduction. It's about the limits of knowledge, and we can test embryos, predict risks, and gather enormous amounts of information, but we still can't know what someone's life will actually be.
It's so true.
Yeah. Did writing the book change your relationship with uncertainty?
Ooh, I think it helped me remember that I can handle uncertainty, because even though I've been through so much and there is so much uncertainty, I think it's a constant in life and there's always going to be a new muscle to learn, like we have even in publishing a book, our first book.
Yeah.
And writing. And I've been through a lot, but it's funny how time goes on and I forget. And then writing it down helps me remember, and helping myself remember, I hope it gives others hope to do the same and to find their way, and that there is kind of no right way in terms of how outside people see it. It's only a right way.
My guest today is Lindsay Bartels. Her debut memoir is called Imogen in Waiting.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.